Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author and journalist Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the murder of Roy Raton. And before we get into the show proper, as always, I have show notes. If you would like to follow me on social media, just search for Ian Totten, author, or The Deathcast. You can find me on most major social media platforms under one of those two monikers. If you are interested in purchasing any of the six novels that I have written, you can find them on Amazon or any other major retail store. That includes places like Barnes & Noble and Walmart. Just search for Ian Totten, that's T-O-T-T-E-N, and you should see them come up. If you enjoy the show and want to help support it, a couple of ways you can do that. First and foremost, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can become a Patreon member. Become one of the Deathcasters or Deathcasterettes, and help offset the cost of producing this show on a weekly basis. The other way that you can help support the show is to go to your favorite podcast app, click the subscribe button, share the show on social media, but also leave a 5-star review. They really do help the show get to more people. And we do have a new 5-star review this week that I am going to be reading. This one is from Aaron Ham. Really great podcast. I just started listening. The truth is coming out. Thank you. Well, thank you, Aaron, for the 5-star review. I'm glad that you appreciate the work I'm doing over here. And if you'd like to get involved in some of the work that I am involved with, a good place to start is to go to justiceforfrank.org and help the Carlson family keep Angelo Pavaju behind bars. Only takes a few minutes. You just click on the link on the justiceforfrank.org website, and they will actually generate a pre-filled out email for you to send to the California Department of Corrections. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, we were talking about how Roy Raton was heading out to Los Angeles after his personal assistant brought it to his attention that his lifestyle was going to bankrupt him and was going to bankrupt him fairly soon. It was costing thousands upon thousands of dollars to keep up on his home, Ocean Castle, but it was also costing him thousands of dollars a week and tens of thousands of dollars a month to keep up on his cocaine addiction. So Raton did decide, you know, I'm gonna go out to LA and see if I can't make it as a movie producer. Now, if you listen to the episode that I recorded where I interviewed my friend, private investigator Ed Opperman, you've probably heard us talking about some pretty shady things involving Roy Raton, one of which was his association with Tiny Tim. Ed told the story about how he had encountered Tiny Tim, I believe it was at a wedding reception, and later was mentioned to him, you know, what would you have done if you hadn't gotten paid? And he basically responded with, oh no, I'm with Mr. Roy Raton. I would have gotten paid. That feeds into some of the darker talk about Roy Raton that has been kicking around for decades. It is known that he was very good friends and was close with a member of the Genovese crime family, and that was a soldier named Johnny Stapelli. So with this kind of backing, Raiden set off for Los Angeles. And we're going to leave Raiden at this point. It's around 82, 83 now. And we're going to shift focus to another character that is heavily involved in this story, and that's a woman by the name of Lainey Jacobs. Lainey was born Karen Jacobs. She was a kind of mousy, platinum blonde-haired woman. Some writers have described her as being stunningly beautiful. That's fine, that's their opinion. From every photograph I have ever seen of her, she looks like your atypical businesswoman of the late 70s, early 1980s, with that kind of bobbed haircut and glasses and a kind of pinched, serious face. Lainey was born in June of 1947 in Birmingham, Alabama. The first child of Alwyn Jerome Jacobs, who was an auto mechanic, and Barbara Jacobs, who was a homemaker. Al seemed to jump jobs fairly regularly during Lainey's upbringing, but they stayed in the Birmingham area. 2 years after Lainey was born, the couple had another child who was named after his father, and would eventually become known as Buddy. In January of 1952, Alwyn and Barbara got a divorce. Numerous reasons have been given for this, such as the family constantly moving around, Alwyn's inability to keep a job, as well as the possibility that he may have been a violent man behind closed doors with his family. Eventually, Lainey's father would move down to Miami, while her mother would remarry, and they had a fairly contentious relationship, with Lainey's father accusing her mother, Barbara, of hiding the children from him. And she ended up moving in with her grandparents, where she entered high school in 1963 at Osborne High School, though this didn't last long, as eventually Lainey and her grandparents moved to Marietta. In high school, she was considered a fairly popular individual, joining the pep club, the drama club, as well as the Future Homemakers of America. She was also fairly active in her grandparents' church, eventually going on to teach Sunday school at the Methodist church where they attended. It's been said that Lainey was a fairly spoiled and temperamental teenager, and that whenever her grandparents displeased her, she would go and live with her mother. During this period of time, early 1960s, Lainey was seen as something of a rebel. It was really socially unacceptable for a young woman to smoke and drink publicly. Lainey did this with wild abandon, possibly as a means to thumb her nose at both her parents as well as her grandparents. But it's also been suggested by Steve Wick in his best-selling book, Bad Company, that Lainey's behavior could be attributed to her troubled upbringing as well as the crowd that she fell into while she was in high school. They were a kind of a fast crowd that liked to run around and get into mischief and do all the kinds of things that you're not supposed to do. In 1971, Lainey married a Cuban man by the name of Manuel Enrique Gonzalez. This marriage, much like her mother's, didn't last long, and she ended up getting divorced. So right around 1973, she ended up getting married again, this time to a man by the name of Leon Scott Goodman. Again, as with her previous marriage, this marriage did not last, and eventually Lainey found herself by 1975 living in Miami. She found herself as a twice-divorced woman at age of 28. Lainey quickly found work as a legal secretary. And it was said that Lainey liked to go out to clubs at night and had a fondness for Latin men. She's been described as someone who loved living the glamorous life, the fast cars, the drugs, the fancy restaurants, the nice clothes, you know, that whole lifestyle that has been glorified for decades by the media. And her friends saw that the crowds that Lainey was running with seemed to possess all of these things, and eventually it was noted by at least 1976, many of the men that Lainey was getting involved with were known drug dealers or drug smugglers. She eventually quit her job working as a legal secretary and began jumping from one job to the another. It seemed always in a quest to find a bigger paycheck. What most people did not know at this period of time, though, was that Lainey had seen what being involved in the drug business could do for people financially as well as their status around town. And she locked onto that and decided that no matter what, she was going to have this. Eventually, she ended up landing a job in a massage parlor where she met a Cuban drug dealer whom Lainey eventually began to date. Lainey Jacobs was a very shrewd, calculating woman. She had been meeting drug dealers since arriving in Miami, and she was very intent on joining with them, so when she would discuss things with these various dealers, she would ask specific questions in order to get a better idea of not only how the drugs were smuggled in, but how they were distributed. And she did this with the sole intent of eventually making enough connections that she would be able to kind of have her own drug empire. One of the ways she did this, and you'll have to excuse the crudity, was she slept her way up to the top. Lainey would get with one dealer and get all of the information she could out of the individual before breaking it off and moving on to another dealer who was a larger dealer than the one she had previously been with. And she continuously did this until she found herself in a position where the dealers she was dealing with could put her in contact with their contacts, and Lainey could start moving product of her own. Lainey ran her drug business just like it was a regular, legitimate business. It was, you know, run out of her house. She had a secretary who was there to answer the phone. She kept detailed records of various transactions, how much she paid out, how much came back in. But Lainey wasn't just selling drugs. She began partaking of the product that she was peddling to the streets, namely cocaine, a little bit of marijuana thrown in on the sides, and anybody who has ever seen the movie Scarface knows about the old adage, you don't get high on your own supply. Lainey seems not to have heeded this particular bit of advice, and she had no problems partying with her customers, having them spend the night before sending them out the next day with their cars loaded with party favors. She eventually met another Cuban man whom she asked to take over the day-to-day operations of her burgeoning enterprises. This man obviously agreed to it, as he saw, much as Lainey had seen others, he saw her as a means to an end, which was to build himself up to be a much larger fish in the drug empire that was taking place in Miami during the late 70s, early 1980s. While the man did agree to take over Lainey's operation, he had reservations. This guy was a kind of a small fry while Lainey was quickly moving herself up the pyramidal hierarchy of the drug smuggling and dealing underworld. And moving up this ladder, the man saw that the individuals Lainey were dealing with were not the same type that he was used to coming into contact with. These were the real deal smugglers and dealers, the kind of men who had no problem killing an entire family in order to make a point to their rivals as well as to their customers who might not be so forthcoming with payments. And obviously this filled the man with fear because he could see that Lainey was moving into shark-infested waters. One of these individuals was a man by the name of Milan Bellachase. Bellachase is a reputed drug dealer of Cuban descent, and he really helped Lainey move up the ladder, so to speak. She went from selling reasonable-sized amounts of narcotics to very quickly upon meeting the man and supposedly beginning a relationship with him to moving mass amounts of cocaine, not just in Miami. Lainey's network extended all the way to the West Coast, specifically to Los Angeles, where unless you've been living under a rock, you're probably already well aware that there's a major market for narcotics in the entertainment capital of the world. Now, eventually, in 1981, narcotics officers got a tip from an informant who let them know about an individual by the name of Fogel who ran and owned a rental car agency, was getting cocaine from Florida. I want to give you a brief, quick overview of things as they stood in the narcotics world during this period of time. Most cocaine came from the state of Florida because the smugglers had created routes and did not, at that time, need to go up through Mexico, thus crossing from Mexico into America and possibly get caught. They'd found ways to move the drugs into places like Miami. And from there, these individuals, mostly Cuban and Colombian dealers, would distribute it to their networks, who would then send it out to the rest of the country. The majority of the cocaine going into Los Angeles at this period of time was coming from Florida. So to get this kind of information from an informant was a big deal. This informant let the police know that this Fogel guy was moving large amounts of cocaine. Eventually, this informant, at the behest of the police, set up a deal. Afterwards, the police took the drugs, and this informant let this individual Fogel know that, hey, the drugs got popped by the cops, so now both these individuals are in a panic. Eventually, four individuals were arrested, and from this arrest, the police put pressure on the individuals, including Fogel, and got him to give them a better idea of the hierarchy of the drug network that he was involved in. One of the names that this man gave was of Milan Bellachase. The other was of Lainey Jacobs. So all of this stuff going on eventually leads Lainey and her live-in boyfriend at the time to travel out to Los Angeles. This was on September 15th of 1981. Lainey went out there to discuss various things with her distribution network, and after this, she and her boyfriend at the time returned to Miami. And it was while in Miami that Lainey decided that Mark Fogel, who had his shipment seized, owed her and Bella Chase for money, so she hired a few men to go out and get the money. And it was also during this period of time that Lainey began to seriously consider whether or not she wanted to stay in Miami or whether she wanted to actually go out to Los Angeles. As she told her boyfriend at this period of time, she had a lot of connections now in Los Angeles and a lot of money, and she was thinking of possibly getting into the movie business. It was also during this period of time that Lainey discovered that she was pregnant for the second time in her life, and it's been said that this news overjoyed her and her boyfriend at the time, and that it's one of the things that really helped spur Lainey on to eventually moving to Los Angeles. Eventually marries this boyfriend of hers, but obviously, as with most of Lainey's relationships, this one was not to last. Final nail in the coffin came when her husband was arrested by officers of the DEA. This is really the thing that made Lainey say, all right, we're done for now in Miami. By late 1982, Lainey, her newborn son, and his nanny were in Los Angeles. While she told many that she was there to get in the movie business, obviously Lainey was really there to work as the West Coast head of Bella Chase's drug empire. She fairly quickly found herself lodgings that suited her and began the process of setting up this network to work better than it had previously when she and Bella Chase were both on the East Coast. Basically, Lainey would have a car come out from Florida loaded with cocaine. It would be emptied out into her garage, and not long after this, another car would arrive and take the cocaine and leave her money. This occurred roughly every 6 weeks. The money that the man picked up from Lainey's house would then be driven to San Francisco, where two individuals would deposit it into local banks. Here is where things start to get murky. Now, Lainey's got this whole network set up. She's looking to get into the movie industry, but she really doesn't know how to go about it, so she starts asking around to her various contacts in the drug underworld, and one of these individuals puts her on to the fact that the limo driver she has been using works for a company that is owned by Robert Evans. Robert Evans, at this period of time, was a sort of down-on-his-luck producer who had made some of the largest movies of the last decade. In addition to this, because of his success as a movie producer, Evans was, for a brief period, the head of Paramount Pictures. But by 1983, Evans' luck had run its course, and as so often happens in Hollywood, he was looking for the next big score, so to speak. In order to do that, in order to produce a movie that's going to be a giant financial hit, he needs backers, who are people who are willing to put up the money in order to make the movie. And he would just kind of oversee all that and allocate the funds to where it needs to go, as well as secure further funding for the production of the film. Through this limousine driver, Lainey ends up meeting Robert Evans, who, unbeknownst to her, it's been said, had a pretty heavy drug problem by this period of time, which is the reason why his career had stalled out so dramatically. This can be witnessed by the fact that Evans had actually been arrested and been able to get a plea deal where he produced a television show called Get High on Yourself, which was one of a slew of really public service announcements that individuals within the entertainment industry would be involved with as part of plea arrangements throughout the 1980s. People said that Evans was a sloppy cocaine addict, and that this might have been one of the reasons why he got into bed with someone like Lainey Jacobs. Whether or not that is true, I do not know. I'm just putting it out there in an effort to be complete in my coverage of this case. At this meeting, Lainey informed Evans that she had access to at least $5 million of her own money to help produce a movie, but that she also had access to more money from friends of hers who were fairly high rollers. Now, Robert Evans always denied knowing that Lainey's money came from narcotics. A friend of Lainey's who was at this meeting stated that she did in fact mention that the money came from drugs. Whatever the truth of the matter is, we'll probably never know. But my own personal opinion, and this is an opinion in case anyone from his estate is feeling litigious, is that if he did not know from the get-go that Lainey's money was coming from drugs, it's gotta be nearly impossible to imagine that with no real means of a lucrative legal business to show for her funds, that he would have not figured out fairly quickly, or at least during their relationship, that Lainey's money was in fact coming from drugs. They had multiple meetings over the ensuing weeks to discuss Lainey getting involved in the production of a meeting. Some have stated that Lainey bewitched Robert Evans with her charms and her good looks, and that Evans kind of fell under her spell. That's possible. I personally think that his addictions may have helped cloud his judgment considerably. It has been stated that Lainey had no problem with supplying Evans with cocaine, and this more likely than not further fueled Robert Evans' judgment in this particular matter. We're switching now back to the main focus of this series, which is Roy Radin. Towards the tail end of 1982, beginning of 1983, Radin goes to Los Angeles with the explicit idea of, hey, I'm going to get involved in movie making. This because his coffers were starting to run dry, despite the fact that he was continuously running these vaudeville shows and managing various second-string entertainers. He was also trying to shake the stigma that had become associated with his name due to the assault that took place at Ocean Castle. But it wasn't just that assault. Again, if you listen to the episode I did with Ed Opperman last week on the show, he talked about the rumors that were floating around involving Roy Radin at that period of time. These rumors have been out there for decades, and at this period of time when Radin was alive, they were really making the rounds. There were people who were saying that Radin had some pretty strange sex parties going on at his house, that orgies were a regular occurrence, that videotapes were made of these various parties, there were also rumors that possibly sexual assaults were a normal occurrence, but not only just sexual assaults. There were also rumors going around that Raiden had in fact participated in snuff films. For those of you who are unaware of what a snuff film is, basically it's a film where an individual, usually a woman, is murdered on camera either during the course of sex or immediately following it, after which the camera will either linger on the woman's body, more things will be done to her, or possibly she will be dismembered. For a long period of time, the United States government, particularly the law enforcement branches of the government, stated that the idea of snuff films being an actual thing were simply that, and it was an idea somebody came up with, and that there was no basis in reality for their existence. This, however, has been refuted numerous times over the last 10 to 15 years, with law enforcement actually finding video evidence of the production of snuff films. Whether or not Raiden was actually involved in something that seedy is one of those things that we will likely never know, but it is important to note in an effort for completeness that he was rumored to be involved in this type of activity while he was living in the Hamptons. After arriving in Los Angeles, Raiden used his connections in the show business industry to meet up with a travel agent whose father was fairly high up in a movie studio, who let him know about a house that was on the market for rent that her father owned. The woman who was currently living in the house was named Lainey Jacobs, and Lainey was in the process of moving out of the home and into another home that she had recently purchased. This woman invited Raiden to a party for her father, who was recently retired, and Raiden jumped at the chance, believing that he would be able to meet individuals within the film industry with whom he could forge a lasting and lucrative relationship. And it was at this party that Roy Raiden met Lainey Jacobs. Roy was immediately taken with Lainey Jacobs. Whether it was because of, you know, the amount of class that she exuded, or that there was some sexual desire on his part, is unknown. What is known is that Raiden knew that Lainey had access to large amounts of cash as well as cocaine. Two things that we've already established Roy Raiden had a voracious appetite for. After this party, Raiden returned to his hotel with Lainey Jacobs and the travel agent, where they had a meal and an impromptu meeting slash party. Now, Raiden's personal assistant, Jonathan Lawson, had obviously traveled to California with him, and he would later state that in the previous few months, he had done a pretty good job of keeping his employer away from cocaine, as he saw that it was the largest hindrance in Roy Raiden's life. However, with the introduction of Lainey Jacobs into Raiden's life, his ability to keep Roy away from the drug was largely nullified, as Lainey had access to seemingly endless amounts of it. After this meeting at the hotel, Lainey invites everyone back to her house, where she shows off to them, and Lainey and Roy continue to do cocaine well into the early morning hours, and she in fact offers for Raiden and Lawson to spend the night. Roy ends up spending the rest of the night there while Lawson goes back to the hotel on his own. Again, it's really unknown whether or not there was a physical relationship between Roy Raden and Lainey Jacobs. Given her penchant for using and tossing aside men in order to further her own power, I would not doubt that Lainey did, in fact, sleep with Roy Raden at this point and possibly over the ensuing months as their relationship began to blossom. After this initial meeting, Raden went back to New York, where he was overseeing basically the dismantling of his life on the East Coast. This included selling Ocean Castle, as well as moving the majority of his belongings into storage units and into an office space that he had rented. While he was there, he kept in constant contact with Lainey Jacobs. And they eventually returned to Los Angeles, where Lainey informed Jonathan Lawson that she was in fact only doing drugs part-time. The majority of her money actually came from helping to set up boutiques in Los Angeles, Florida, and Nevada. During this trip to Los Angeles, Raden began setting up meetings with friends of his within the entertainment industry, trying to sell a number of scripts that he had, one of which was The Cotton Club, a film that was to be based on the famous Harlem nightclub of the same name. Because of these meetings, Raden had the possibility to sell a television show to Paramount, which, if I'm not mistaken, either fizzled out or possibly was changed into the television show Bosom Buddies. At any rate, he ended up hooking up with Lainey again while he was in California, and Lawson saw that his boss was once again getting heavily involved in narcotics. They ended up going back to New York for a brief period of time, during which Raden attempted to get off of drugs, which unfortunately for him was to no avail. Eventually, Raden ends up back on the West Coast, and the car he's driving, a rented Mercedes, ends up being stolen. So Lainey gets him a car through Foley's rental agency. And it's at this point that Jonathan Lawson discovers the name of a man named Bellachase, whom Lainey claims is the father of her son and is also her husband. And this is important in that up until this point, neither he nor Raden knew that Lainey was possibly involved with another individual outside of Roy Raden. And it was during this trip that Lainey let slip that she has had meetings with Robert Evans, the famed movie producer, and that these meetings may in fact bear fruit. It's through Lainey that Roy Raden ends up meeting Robert Evans. This took place roughly at the end of March, and they had a meeting where Raden began discussing his plans. Raden informed the two of them that he wanted to produce a musical based on The Cotton Club. Evans himself stated that he had thought about doing a movie based on The Cotton Club, although he didn't see it as a musical, but more in the vein of The Godfather, kind of a dark, gritty crime-type film. And from this meeting, really, the seeds were sown for Lainey Jacobs and Roy Raden to have their falling out. As Raden saw Lainey as a broker who had introduced him to the people that he needed to be in business with, not someone who was going to be a partner, whereas Lainey saw herself as being an integral part of the team. Raiden was over the moon over the idea of doing a film with Robert Evans, despite the fact that both his personal assistant, along with numerous contacts within Hollywood, all warned him about getting into bed with Evans, given Evans' drug habits as well as his string of flops in movie theaters and on television. But Raiden was not to be persuaded from this. Unbeknownst to Raiden, Evans had been pitching the idea of a Cotton Club movie around Hollywood for at least a year prior to Roy Raiden and Lainey Jacobs becoming involved, and each time that it looked like Evans had a deal in place with contracts signed, the partners ended up backing out, owing to Evans' prodigious cocaine habits. After this meeting, Raiden and Lawson returned to New York City to oversee what was left of his business, and while they were there, Raiden received a phone call from Lainey Jacobs that completely shifted the dynamic of their relationship. Lainey had had a shipment of cocaine couriered in from Florida, and the shipment had been stolen. Lainey believed that Raiden, who had been staying at the Regency where Lainey's courier was staying, had in fact partnered with the man to steal the shipment. Lainey's train of thought was that Raiden had been partying with this man whose last name was Rogers, and that during this partying with him, they had conspired together. And Lainey did have proof that Raiden, in fact, knew Rogers, as there were two checks made out totaling $15,000 for cocaine purchases. Raiden blew this off, rightfully knowing that he had had nothing to do with it, and believing that this would eventually blow over. However, Lainey Jacobs was not so forgiving a person. It should be noted that more likely than not, she knew that Roy Raiden did not, in fact, steal her cocaine and that her courier had been responsible for it. But she used it as an excuse later on down the line in order to set the events in motion that we are going to be discussing shortly. The reality of the theft was that Rogers had had an argument with Lainey Jacobs and Bella Chase concerning payment for his currying trips, with Lainey refusing to pay his demanded price. So Rogers waited until he knew that Lainey would not be around, and he went back to the house and stole 10 kilos of cocaine as well as $270,000 from the safe that was in the back of her garage before he fled the state. So after this argument with Roy Raiden on the phone, Lainey, who's was probably pretty coked up herself, decided to reach out to Mark Fogel, who was the manager/drug courier that she knew in California. Lainey informed Fogel about the theft that had taken place at her house, informing him that she was almost positive that it was her courier, Tally Rogers, who had done the stealing. And at this point, Lainey does something that is going to forever alter her life. Fogel had a former employee by the name of Bill Menser. Menser was a former member of Charles Manson's family, who was eventually to get the moniker of Manson II. He was a bodybuilder with a thick, bushy mustache and long hair, who at this period of time was working for Larry Flint as a bodyguard, this following the failed assassination attempt on Larry Flint's life that left him a cripple. Laney had met Mensur once before, but following this theft of the cocaine and money from her house, she decided that she needed to hire him to be her bodyguard. Mensur was, and still is, a pretty bad individual. He's suspected in numerous contract killings throughout the years. Some sources have actually stated that he was, in fact, a serial killer who got into the murder-for-hire business as a means of mixing business with pleasure. Whether or not Jacobs knew any of this information at the period of time we're talking about really is unknown. But she went into this situation of hiring Mensur with the idea of removing her courier, Tally Rogers. It was through Mensur that Laney hired a private investigator in an effort to track Rogers down. The man's name was Michael Pascal. Mensur also brought other individuals into their working relationship, one of whom was a man by the name of Alex Marty, who was said to basically be Mensur's right-hand man. Marty also worked for Larry Flint as a bodyguard, and it's been said that the things in his life that were most important to him were violence and money. It's also been alleged that he was a card-carrying member of the Nazi Party of the United States, that he adored Adolf Hitler and had an extreme dislike for Jews. Marty had been quoted numerous times as stating, quote, "To really put someone away, you have to shoot them in the back of the head. That's the way that the Nazis do it." With this trio in place, Laney goes on about her business, paying the private investigator to keep an eye on her home while Mensur and Marty would stay inside of the house or sit out front within vehicles. So you've got all of this going down. Laney and her crew is trying to track down the courier. Roy Radin and his team are also trying to track down Rogers. But Radin's main focus was on getting movies made. He began making phone calls in order to raise enough capital to get the first of three pictures produced, while informing Robert Evans of what was going on, and the two of them really began to solidify their working relationship unbeknownst to Laney Jacobs. Upon returning to Los Angeles, Radin and Jacobs had another blow-up on the telephone where Laney accused Radin of getting Rogers to commit the theft at her house, something that Radin vehemently denied being involved with or of knowing about. After this, Radin pretty much goes on coke binges over the next few days to few weeks, during which he visits Robert Evans and they negotiate various things, only to find out after the fact that everything needs to be renegotiated because the two men were too high to be able to come to any sort of coherent agreements. During this period of time, Laney Jacobs reached back out to Roy Radin, basically, you know, saying that there was no bad blood between the two of them. What neither of them knew, though, was that Laney, still suspecting Roy was involved in this, was bringing another friend along with her, a woman by the name of Anna, who she was going to use to spy on the two men to find out if they in fact knew anything about what was going on with Rogers and the theft. Obviously, neither man knew anything more than she had told them, and her friend was unable to gain any useful information. What came out of this, however, was Raiden was continuing to negotiate with Robert Evans, and when he sent over a contract to Evans, Jacobs called him and began screaming at him on the phone, accusing Raiden of going behind her back to get into bed with Evans. He basically informed Lainey that Evans was currently out of the area and that once he returned, the three of them would sit down and iron out all of the misunderstandings. Lainey, however, was not to be put off, and by most accounts, she continued to harass Roy Raiden over the next few days. Meanwhile, Raiden went about trying to set up another vaudeville tour, with Milton Berle acting as the MC. Eventually, Lainey was able to talk to Roy, at which point he informed her that there was no place for her within the company he was building with Robert Evans. Raiden also went on to accuse Lainey of selling him bad cocaine, blaming the nosebleeds that he had been experiencing frequently over the last few days on her drugs, which Lainey began screaming at him over, stating to Roy that it's not bad drugs, you're just using way too much of it. Raiden ended up canceling payment on a $4,000 check that had been made out to Lainey, which further added fuel to the fire. After these events, Raiden was informed by his mother that his apartment at the Mayflower Hotel in New York had been burglarized. So Raiden is preparing to head back to New York to deal with this apartment burglarization when Jonathan Lawson informs him that he believes that Lainey's friend Anna, who has been spending a lot of time with the two of them, is probably spying on her. Raiden, in his drug-addled mind, refuses to believe this, although on the day that they set out for New York, he does confront Anna over these accusations. Anna, breaking down in tears, insists that she is not, in fact, spying for Lainey, but she does warn Roy Raiden that he needs to be careful around her, as Lainey is a very dangerous woman with a lot of high-powered connections to the drug underworld, which Raiden pretty much dismisses out the gate. While Roy's dismissing this, however, Anna goes on to talk with Lawson and inform him that Lainey and Bellachase are not, in fact, married. They are business partners, and that Bellachase is a huge player in the drug trafficking industry, and that Bellachase had been putting a lot of pressure on Lainey over these stolen drugs and money, and that Lainey had, in fact, been using Roy as a scapegoat with Bellachase. Information that the two men should have heeded immediately, although unfortunately they did not. We are going to leave the story for this week at this point with Roy Raiden, and now he's traveled back to New York to look at his apartment, unaware of the things that are taking place between Robert Evans and Lainey Jacobs. We will pick it up next week. Again, if you enjoyed this show, please subscribe wherever it is that you get your favorite podcasts, leave a 5-star review, and share the show on social media. If you want to find me online, just search for The Deathcast or Ian Totten, author. Until next time, The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid.